The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
KNUS Denver. The voice of the people. News Talk 710. Warning, the contents of this program could help you think for yourself. It's the Peter Boyle Show on News Talk 710, KNUS.
Here's a lady who's now going to give a description of hell. Mark this tape. In fact, don't lose tonight's tape. This is an award winner. Now, caller, please explain to me. I would love that you should describe for our audience the condition of hell.
Nothing but burning sulfur. You will not
burning sulfur.
One of your friends. Not a single.
How long would I burn you? Like how long? Like time would I plan
years.
On? How long?
So you will have a second death there in hell.
Well, I mean, how does it go down? I mean, how do I actually do this thing?
Radio talk show host Alan Berg. She's explaining hell to him. Good morning. It is a Friday, June the 18th, 2021. 88 to high today. 85 tomorrow. We have rain in the cast, and of course, on that terrible night. The 18th of June, 1984, 37 years ago, the prominent talk show host in the city, gunned down in his driveway in Adams Street, but it's so much more than that. This man is, in my estimation, the most decent elected official in the city of Denver. We've become friends over time. His name is Kevin Flynn, but back when he was a newsman, he was when I had to go to Seattle to the trials and the trials here in Denver, Kevin was always there, and still is a great friend. And he and the late Gary Gerhardt did the definitive book of everything that happened. First of all, hey, Kevin, thank you so much, man, and thanks for coming on.
Certainly. Certainly. How you been? I haven't talked to you in a long time.
You know, we saw each other for dinner about, 17 months ago or whatever that was. And
Yeah. It was like, well, there was a lost year in between there, right?
I think you're right. but I'll give you a little bit of good
did
news.
Did anything ever come of that?
They're coming on the show. The people that you and I had dinner with are coming on this morning at 7:30 to talk about the film. Kevin, of course, Kevin and the late Gary Gerhardt did the book. But the good thing is I've been trying to pressure somebody to mark Allen's murder and the Denver Press Club. And it looks like we're pretty close to it, having him admitted or brought into the Press Club Hall of Fame. So that's the good news. Mm-hmm. And so we'll leave it there. Kevin, of course, you were working at the Rocky when all of that happened, I was trying to plan out the show for the last couple of days. Begin with in 78, a book is published entitled "The Turner Diaries," and it was written by a guy by the name of William Luther Pierce. Pick the story up there and why it's important.
Well, the Turner Diaries, written by William Pierce. William Pierce was a leader of a neo-Nazi group called the National Alliance back in Arlington, Virginia, I believe it was. And this it's a fictional account of a white supremacist takeover of the United States. And I never went along with the idea that this was their Bible of the Silent Brotherhood or the Order, but they certainly enjoyed reading it and selling it and spreading it around to all their friends, right? Using it as a recruitment tool, and it particularly was liked by a fellow by the name of Robert Matthews. Have you talked about Bob Matthews?
I have not. I've waited for you to come on to talk.
Okay, Bob Matthews was a fellow who grew up in Arizona, born in Marfa, Texas, of all places. Family moved to Phoenix when he was young. Went to school there, and he, as he grew up, he read a lot of interesting stories about communism and anti-communism. Who was fighting communism? This was during the Red Scare. This was when Barry Goldwater was running for president in 1964, and he just became captured by a lot of this propaganda. Joined a chapter of the John Birch Society in Phoenix. And that put him on a path that eventually led him to being arrested for for failure to pay taxes, et cetera, et cetera. He actually formed a little paramilitary group down in the Phoenix area, Cave Creek, Arizona. After his arrest and his release, his parents thought he had turned a corner. He said, I want to get away from all this. A friend of his had been turned on his other friends and killed them. And he said, I had enough of this. So he moves up to the Pacific Northwest, buys a little place up in the Selkirk Mountains north of Spokane, and by all accounts set out on living a productive life up there. But you know what was up in that area? You know it well, sure. The Aryan Nations sure. compound yeah. in Hayden Lake, Idaho. It no longer exists up there.
It's a park now. Did you know they've converted that to a park?
Really?
Yeah. I still have contact.
You know what? Yeah, I got a little update on this, by the way. That was founded by a fellow by the name of Richard Butler. Richard Butler grew up here in Denver. The house he grew up on is still sitting there on Lincoln Street. His dad ran a machine shop mm-hmm. In the garage behind his house between Lincoln and Broadway. And eventually moved out to Lancaster, California, Los Angeles area, and he ended up founding the Aryan Nations. He had a church there in the Los Angeles area, but he moved it up to Hayden Lake to get away from Southern California. Well, Bob Matthews was drawn into the Aryan Nations and met a lot of people there, many of whom ended up in his little paramilitary group that he called Bruderschweigen, the Silent Brotherhood. And it was patterned after the group in the Turner Diaries, yeah. just to close the loop there. The order.
Yeah, they took it from the book. Yeah, right. Sorry.
In the book, it was called The Order. Bob didn't name it The Order, but that's what people called it. So that's what they called themselves after the media picked it up. And started out pretty small, counterfeiting a couple of adult bookstore robbery, things like that. Bob robbed a bank over in the Seattle area. And it sort of built from there, and people watched, his friends watched Bob doing this stuff, and he sort of said, we're going to follow this guy. We like what he talks about, and he's putting words into action. So they organized the group of nine guys around a white infant in a two-story shed on his property. Mm-hmm. They took an oath, a little candlelit ceremony, and it grew from there. It grew into armored car robberies, Allen's assassination, mm-hmm. the paramilitary organizing. They actually used some of the money that they stole to buy property up in Priest Lake, Idaho, as a training camp. I think it's about mm-hmm. God, it's about 100 acres or so. And they set up camp there. They had tents set up. And they were going to... the FBI believes that had they not stopped Matthews in December of 1984, he had been planning a sabotage on the Los Angeles metropolitan area. Power lines, water supply, poisoning, things like that. If they hadn't stopped him, who knows where that would have gone. But Allen's, as it turns out, Allen's killing was a huge error on his part in strategic planning. That really brought the heat down on him.
They so much as said that, did they not? Our guest, the one and only Kevin Flynn, now city councilman extraordinaire, but then a writer and great reporter, has been a longtime friend. I'm a huge, huge fan of Kevin's. But they said that. They're alleged to have said the Jew is now greater in death, or some words like that. Mm-hmm. You recall that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And matter of fact, the MAC-10 weapon that was used to kill him
brings him down.
Became sort of an icon for them. Yeah. One of the members had it up on an altar in his house up in Idaho.
Gary, the
police found it, and that's what they were able to link to the whole gang to the killing through that. Matthews said, you should have thrown that thing away.
I don't mean to interrupt, but it was Gary Lee Yarborough, and then Matthews told him to dispose of it, and he couldn't do it.
Right. He says, we can't get rid of this. This is like the beginning of the movement.
The Grail.
And it really was a deviation from their plan. they didn't plan, and you'll remember this once I start talking about it. The plan was a five-step plan, and you know, step five was assassinations. They were still on what step two or three,
yeah, two.
Which was building their war chest. Yeah. A month after they killed Allen, they stopped. They did an open road armored car robbery in Ukiah, California. They got away with $2.8 million, and had they kept doing that instead of having killed Allen, who knows what would have happened. Because that's really what put them hot on the trail, the FBI.
Kevin Flynn.
Was Berg's assassination.
Kevin Flynn's here. How did Matthews meet David Lane, who plays out in Denver? How did he meet David Lane?
David was a member of the Klan here in Denver for years. And he became an adherent of Richard Butler's Up at Aryan Nations. And he would go up to the camp up there and stay, provide security services. And that's where Bob met him, at some of the rallies up at Aryan Nations. But prior to that, you know, David was active down here in the Denver area. And he was actually, you recall Alan's show. You know that, right?
Yeah.
He called Alan's show a few times and tape recorded some of the exchanges that Alan had with white supremacists and the fellow up in Fort Lupton,
yep,
who published that newspaper, Primrose Cattleman's Gazette.
Rick Elliott.
Which had, yeah, and had some, ran some anti-Semitic articles.
That's how it started.
So you can pick up the story.
Well, I talked to him, but, you know, and it was David Lane was his part-time printer, part-time bodyguard.
After that show, when that newspaper suffered financial losses because of all the publicity that you guys gave him, bad publicity, right? Pat Schroeder, who was in Congress at the time,
I
got the Marine Corps to pull her ads.
No, I called her. I called Pat Schroeder, and I said, what are you doing? And she was on Armed Services Committee. I think she was the head of it. And I said, Pat, look at these ads and look at this story. And the guy's name was Rick Elliott, Roderick. He sued Allen and I. He sued GE, me and Berg. But looking back, when we took him on for the first time, and then Allen wanted him, and I talked too much about this earlier, but then Berg takes him on. You know, Berg was a brawler. And what we don't know is that David Lane is in the other room listening. And I think, but then all of these people meet each other. Bruce Pierce. How does Bruce Pierce play out in this?
Oh, man. Boy, I haven't thought about all this for a long time.
I apologize.
Fine. Bruce was drawn out to the Aryan Nations. He was a member there. He was hanging out there. And this is a guy who, you know, this is going to sound stupid,
please,
maybe, in retrospect. But he had, you know, most of these guys who followed Matthews had no criminal records. They were simply drawn to Aryan Nations by what Pastor Butler was preaching about the superiority of the white race. We got to defend ourselves. We have to build what Bob Matthews ended up calling the white American bastion, up in the, you know, the 10% solution, they called it. They wanted 5 of the 50 states to be a white nation. So they called it the 10% solution. Mm-hmm. And so, Bob eventually got, Aryan Nations eventually got tied up in some counterfeiting. The little printing press they had up there in Hayden Lake, they started printing some phony money, and Bruce Pierce got busted for passing phony money. That was the first illegal thing he had done in his life, and ended up being arrested. That's why Bob, by the way, robbed the bank in the Seattle area, was to raise money for Bruce's family and to get him and to raise his bail money. And when he robbed the bank, it was snowing in Seattle, which is not usual in the winter, but it was snowing in Seattle, and Bob robbed this bank. It was in Innes Arden.
Mm-hmm.
And the teller had snuck a dye pack into the bag when she loaded the money in it. And no sooner did Bob round the corner, the teller looked out the window and saw this big puff of red smoke around the corner. And the dye pack had gone off, and the money was stained, which would mark it as having been stolen. And so Bob took a lot of that money. They threw a lot of it away, but he was able to salvage a lot of it. They used Zip Strip on it and some kind of paint remover, and they ended up turning, instead of really green, they were kind of bluish, had a bluish tint to them. So they called them bluebacks instead of greenbacks. Yeah. Okay. But that's how Bruce kind of got on that slippery slope. And he is the he's the guy that they assigned the task of killing Alan, of using the MAC-10. So Bruce would practice with it out in the woods where he lived. I think he lived in Libby, Montana, which is also very close to the Idaho Panhandle, up there in the far northern Panhandle. So Bruce is the guy who waited outside on Colfax and Adams, waited for Alan to show up after he had dinner. Yeah. There were four of them there, and they waited him out. As you know, he was out to dinner with his ex-wife that night.
Judy Burke.
Out in Lakewood, the old Jefferson 440.
We went there all the time. Oh, we had a trade.
Yes, we had great.
Yeah, well,
that's right. There's a Walmart there now.
Well, that one, and down the street from that was a place called, was owned by a guy named Joel Barron, and it was called, it was like a prime rib joint. And
was it the Tally-Ho?
There it is. Bingo. And there's a great Berg story out of that. And it was, we were having dinner, and Joel loved Alan. And I think Linda was with us that night, and May, I had a friend with me. And we're sitting there, and this is a Berg story. And I see this woman beelining out of the bar, and she's coming at him. And I'm going, oh, man, he's no slugger. And she's going to jump him, you know, about the radio show, how he acted. So right behind her is this big guy. It's her husband. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I've been through this one a couple of times. And I'm thinking, okay, what do I do? Because he's not a slugger. And she gets over to the table. She starts lighting him up. And her husband's right, Kevin, true story. And he does that, sir, sir. You know, he interrupts everybody. And he looks at the guy, and he says, what do you do for a living? Sir, what do you do for a living? And the guy said he was like a block layer or a brick foreman or some construction stuff. And Burke said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, you come to my house tomorrow and lay bricks, and I'll talk to your wife. And the guy takes his wife by the elbow and takes her back to the bar. I'm looking at him, and I'm trying to find a wine bottle or something. A guy got to slug this guy because he's huge. And remember people, like, they could whistle down dogs? You know, the dog goes down. He did it. Kevin, I watched him do it. And I'm looking at him like, and he just goes back and continues to eat. And I'm going, Jesus, how did you pull that one off? But that was, so the other guy I wanted to bring up, Kevin Flynn is, like, the best. They raid Portland, Oregon, and on Gary Lee Yarbrough, and that's where they find the MAC-10.
They found it in this house up in Sandpoint.
Okay,
Sandpoint,
Idaho. I apologize, but it was Gary's house, right?
Yes, up in the attic.
And they had made an altar.
Yep, with an icon of
Adolf Hitler.
Correct.
Man,
and a couple of candles on either side of it.
Who was Richard Scutari? He was the bank robber also. Who was Scutari?
He was a guy, I'm trying to recall, grew up on Long Island. Boy, now you're really...
I remember he was a Navy diver. He was the tough guy. Scutari was legitimately a tough guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he became the head, what they called the head of security. They called him Mr. Black.
Mr. Black, yes.
And he would do voice stress test analyzation of any recruits to try to determine if they were the genuine article, were they serious. He would do stress tests on them, a voice test. I grew up in Long Island, and when he ended up joining, he was recruited out of Florida. And for the life of me, I can't remember what the nexus was there, how he connected to that group. But I'd have to go back and read the book.
He was the last guy caught. Go back and read your book. He was, and Kevin's book is the book, Kevin and Gary. But he was.
I got to tell you something, by the way. You said the book, right? Can I?
Sure, of
if
course.
I can take a side trip
here.
Please. Harriet, my wife, recently went online to see if she could get a couple copies of it on Amazon or eBay or whatever. And I found out something really interesting. She bought three books online so I could have a few copies here. They're soft cover versions of the hardcover. And I looked at it and I said, what the heck? This was never published by my publisher. And so I called my agent back in New York. We hadn't talked in years. I said, could you find out how this is done? It turns out, long story short, Simon & Schuster has a service called Books on Demand. And if you order it through them, they print one up and they mail it to you. And it saves them the cost of warehousing, and pre-printing, hoping something sells. So they don't print the book unless someone's buying it. I had never heard of this. So I got, I'm looking at one that's sitting right here on my coffee table. It's got the original hardcover cover art on it.
Wow.
Unlike the two paper, it came out twice in paperback, once about a year after the hardcover, and then it was reissued after the Oklahoma City bombing. I don't know if you want to go that far down the rabbit hole, but
Tim McVeigh
was a fan
sold it.
Of the order.
He traveled and sold the book.
He sold Turner Diaries.
Yeah.
He didn't sell my book, but he sold Turner Diaries.
Right.
He had gun shows, and he went to the real big Tulsa show that they do twice a year and was selling Turner Diaries.
Yeah.
It tied into Tim McVeigh. So the paperback version of our book came out twice. But it's out of print for years. I tell people, hey, I bought your book on eBay the other day. So, well, that's nice. I don't actually make any more money off
it.
Right?
Oh, God. It is the difference.
One guy told me back when the book first came out, he says, hey, I bought your guys' book the other day. Oh, and then real apologetically says, oh, but I haven't read it yet. I don't care. I don't get any more money if you actually then read it. If you got it out of the library and read it, I'd be less impressed than if you actually bought it.
I'm gonna turn here. I want you to come. We come back about Jean Craig and her daughter, and the murder. Here he is. Truly, you guys, this is the best guy, Kevin Flynn, and Mark Crowley's going to join us in a little bit. Susan Ryman's going to join us, and professional appraisal. By the way, this is one of the ways they knew each other. David Ellis had this place downtown. His original place when he came and he opened up his original jewelry store, and he knew Alan. Alan had, he started out with the shirt broker, and they were making custom shirts, and then they made the boot broker, and I think there was somewhere where David and Alan and I, and David Ellis and Cherry Creek paying top dollar for your diamonds and your gold and sterling silver, wedding bands, and Rolex watches, instant cash on the spot. David's been buying precious metals and antiques in Colorado for decades. David Ellis offers confidential valuations on estate sale jewelry and precious metals and coins and silver sets and antique items. You need some vacation dough. This is a great way to just go get it done or buy a gift. You know, June is always the month for graduations and weddings, and there's no obligation. Free appraisals, private and confidential, park and walk in. Looking to buy something special? See David Ellis. You need money right now? See David Ellis. Beautiful, beautiful, newly remodeled, expanded showroom. The black awning on the showroom. 3rd and Clayton at Cherry Creek. 6 days a week, David's there today. Be there tomorrow. 3rd and Clayton at Cherry Creek. DavidEllisJewelry.com. DavidEllisJewelry.com. 303-322-8779. 303-322-8779. You'll be glad you did.
Let's go back to the phone. We are going to Montbello. You're on KOA.
Yes, Alan. I heard the last two calls. I want to ask you one question. I know you're a lawyer, have been a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I'll note. If this had been a black woman shooting a white man five times in the face, what do you think would happen?
I think that you're doing two races on this issue. I think that today people don't justify this kind of activity anywhere, anytime. In other words, I don't think that the race is a question here. I think if a black woman shot a white man five times in the face, I think she'd probably do time.
See, okay. There,
yes, well,
that's
sampling
the man. The assassination of radio talk show host Alan Berg. It was 37 years ago on the 18th, 1984, the man's life was taken. Who do we got on? We have, okay, let me bring them both on. Kevin Flynn, who is the best city councilman and longtime friend and wrote the book. And I'm bringing Mark Crowley on, Kevin, with us. He was then a third-year police officer on the street that night. Hey, Marky, thanks, man. Good morning. I don't know if you and Kevin have ever met before or not. I suspect you have, but
No, actually, we have not met.
Okay.
Good morning, anyway.
All right. Kevin Mark's with us. I wanted to ask two questions. One is to describe who Gene Craig was, and then why did they murder him? What was the reason to kill him? And then Mark talking about the street that night. So, Kevin, if you'd be first, please.
Sure, okay. Gene Craig was the mother of a woman named Zilla Craig, who Bob Matthews met up at a church in La Porte outside of, where is that, up near Fort Collins, one of those Christian identity white nationalist churches.
That's right.
And Zilla was attending. She lived in Laramie, Wyoming. And Jean was her mother, and Bob sort of was caught up with Zilla. They ended up having a child together. And Jean was assigned by Bob to do surveillance on Alan. She was down there. You guys were down on Lawrence Street at the time, KOA.
Mm-hmm.
And she stopped in. She got the publicity packet on him. So she had his picture. She looks him up in the crisscross. She finds his place on Adams Street. She finds out, when does he usually leave? When does he usually come back? And she turned that report over to Bob Matthews and the rest of the group. And they said, oh, this is a great job, you know. And that's what led them out to the 1400 block of Adams. They actually waited quite a long time. They had their rental car, I think it was a Plymouth, and they got out of the car. They parked at the old Taco John's out at near Colfax and Adams, stayed in the parking lot. Bruce Pierce got out with the MAC-10, was in a tennis racket case. Or something like that is what they told me. By the way, a lot of this account comes from Bruce Pierce. He gave us a boatload of interviews in jail. I met him out at Leavenworth Federal Prison, where he was first being held. And then when he came back here for the trial, he was being held in the Arapahoe County Jail down in the Centennial area, down near Centennial Airport. And so Gary and I, after the trial each day here in Denver, we would go down and interview him in the visiting area, in the jail. And we got, you know, we had boatloads of info from the tapes we made. So this is how we know what they were doing on the street that day, that evening. And they waited for him to come back. Oh, and the frightening thing here is, you know, when he pulled up in that black Volkswagen Bug, he had his ex-wife in the car with him. At first, they pulled into the driveway. They were going to call Alan's mother back in Chicago because her birthday was the next day. And when they pull in the driveway, Alan says, you know, it's been a long day. Let's call Mom tomorrow. Let me take you back to your car. So the Bug was still running. These guys are waiting at the curb in the Plymouth. Alan puts the Volkswagen in reverse and drops Judith off, his ex-wife. Her car was parked down at the old Cherry Creek Shopping Center before they redid it. The old one. And so he drives Judith back to the car. Then he returns alone, gets out of the car. He lit a cigarette, gets out of the car. He had a can of dog food and shaving cream in a shopper bag. And that's when Bruce got out of the back seat. Bob Matthews was in the shotgun seat. They blocked the driveway, pull across the driveway. Bob gets out, opens the rear door of the sedan. Bruce gets out with the gun, walks up the driveway a few steps, and sprays him with 13 bullets.
Why, Kevin? What was there when they, I mean, I...
Why they wanted people to know. They wanted to send a signal to anti-Semites, to Christian identity folk, to neo-Nazi folk. They knew that this would be seen as exactly what it was, and that it would draw people to their movement and whatnot. I know you're going to hear from Mark in a second, mm-hmm. but I got to tell you, when Gary Gerhart was our police reporter at the Rocky, he goes over and he talks to, I think it was Pete Diaz, one of the detectives, and he says, hey, do you have any suspects?
The phone book.
Who could have done this? Do you have any suspects?
The phone book.
And he picks up, the guy picks up the phone,
oh,
the
yeah.
Denver phone book.
Oh, yeah.
Remember phone books? Right. He picks up the phone book, plops it down on the desk in front of Gary and says, yeah, all of these.
I've heard those stories. Right? Here comes the phone book.
How many people did he, can I say piss off on the air?
You just
How
did.
Many people did Alan anger
oh.
anger over the years like you know, that would have wanted to kill him?
They did a,
so,
there was a poll yeah. done. He was the most loved and most hated in the same poll.
That's right. The man you yeah. love to hate.
Absolutely.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like on the street, sure. Mark? That you were your third year as a cop, right?
Yeah, I was
my third year, I was working in the traffic division at that time and was just finishing up my shift that evening. It was hot. I do remember that. And I had just finished a traffic accident and was going to head for traffic operations. I was leaving 17th and Claremont or something, right in that vicinity where I handled an accident. And that had the call had come out. And so I just called. I was right there. So I, just volunteered to go down there and be part of the cordon because, they got to isolate the crime scene and all that sort of thing. And it was pretty typical. I didn't know who it was at the time. A pretty typical crime scene. You could tell it was very brutal just by looking at what was happening there. But what was so amazing to me is how fast, once the word began to get out into the community, how fast people started to gather around there. So many, by midnight, there were dozens and dozens of people. The cordon, once they figured out who it was and the type of crime it was, they broadened the cordon quite a bit, so the crime scene was pretty broad. But I was amazed at how many people came out that late at night just to kind of see what was going on, and so you can see how really well-known Alan was and how that word spread so fast once it got out.
Kevin, how did they – I mean, I've listened to the Denver cops, and the phone book story has now become legion. Pick one, or worse to that effect. And when finding the gun, but wasn't there also they tracked something back to the counterfeiters in Philly? How did all that come together to they could put these?
Well, first of all, the guys who worked the intel unit at DPD were really good. They had really good files on who the Klan members were and in the Denver area, and. I'm going to be pretty hazy on the details, but the intel unit had some information on David Lane. They didn't arrest him. They had stopped him. He was on his way to distribute some Klan literature one time when he was pulled over for something or other, and they confiscated his Klan literature. And for some reason that escapes me at the moment, he was on the radar, and one of the guys in the intel unit went to the team meeting on this, and he says, I actually have a guy we ought to be looking at. His name's David Lane. He's a member of the Klan. Alan Berg was Jewish. He was outspoken against the Klan. He had that run-in with Fred Wilkins.
I was part of that, too, when that happened.
Yes, exactly. And so he said, we need to put this guy high on our radar. So he became a suspect. The morning after they killed Alan, David took off for Pennsylvania, and he met a guy named Tom. His name is Tom Martinez, mm-hmm. but he always insisted that it was Martinez.
Yeah.
He was
Spanish.
Spanish,
that's right.
Oh, right. And they gave him some counterfeit bills to pass in the Philadelphia area. And then this is an odd personal link. David, after he dropped the money off in Philadelphia, he drives about an hour or so north to my hometown where I grew up, Easton, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And it turns out that David Lane's brother-in-law, the guy who married the guy who married David Lane's sister, was a guy who graduated from my high school with some good friends of my mom and dad in the late 50s. And he stayed with him a few days, just about 8 blocks from where I grew up in Easton, and hid out there for a little bit. But Tom Martinez passes this counterfeit money around the Philadelphia area. He buys a pack of gum here and there. I think it was $10 bills that they counterfeited. So he would, buy something really cheap with the phony 10, and he'd get, $9.45 in change in real money. That's how they were raising some of their loot. This is before they did the Brinks robbery in Ukiah in July of '84. And Martinez gets busted. One of the shopkeepers realized later it was counterfeit. And lo and behold, Tom goes back to the same place a couple days later to pass another bill to the same guy. And the guy says, hey, you're the guy that gave me that phony bill a couple of days ago. I'm calling the cops. And he runs. And Tom actually came back to that shop with a real $10 bill and tried to apologize and make it up. Says, you know, can you give me that old bill back? I'm sorry. But no, he got busted for it.
The Treasury guys got him.
The FBI worked on him. Yeah. They worked on him, and he finally cracked, and he agreed to make a call to Bob Matthews, mm-hmm. who was heavily recruiting Tom to join the order, and went out to Portland. That's that Portland hotel mm-hmm. incident, the raid where they arrested Gary Arbour that you referred to earlier. And you know what really cracked the case, though, was when they robbed that Brinks truck, Bob Matthews, the leader of the gang,
he had borrowed
a handgun from one of the other members. And after they stopped the truck and they were unloading the bags from the back of the truck, he puts it in the waistband of his pants. And as they're leaning over and lifting these heavy bags of money into the pickup trucks, the gun worked its way out of his waistband and fell onto the floor of the armored truck. And he didn't realize it. They left it behind. So when the FBI is gathering evidence in Ukiah, they see this gun there. And one of the drivers of the Brinks truck says, "That's the gun that the leader was pointing at me." And so the biggest mistake of the whole, Bob's biggest mistake in the whole history of this gang was left that gun behind. It was registered in the name of one of the gang members under his real name because he had bought it a couple of years before anyone ever heard of doing this, of organizing this gang. And that was the keyhole through which all the evidence ended up passing.
A couple of seconds left, and Susan Ryman is going to be with us. Mark Crowley and Kevin Flynn. Is there any? Is Richard Scutari still alive? Who is still alive out of all of this?
Bruce Pierce died in prison. David Lane died in prison. Gary Yarbrough, I heard, also died in prison. I think Scutari is still in prison.
Gene Craig
said he was.
Gene Craig died in prison.
Gene Craig passed away. Yeah. She died in prison.
Yeah.
I haven't looked for any of these folks in years. In years, but I only saw those, you know, when they were in the mm-hmm. news. Mm-hmm. The New York Times recently did a piece on the main FBI agent in this, Wayne Manis.
Oh yeah,
I don't know if you remember him.
Of course,
I do. He lived across the valley from Aryan Nations, and he used to be able to watch him through a little telescope on his deck. Gary and I went and visited him up at his place, and when we were doing the book,
he was a really good guy. I met him in Seattle. He was a good guy.
Oh, he's the first character in the book. When you read the prologue, he's the first guy when they're staked out on Whidbey Island, and it's, you know, it's a couple hours before the big shootout where Matthews mm-hmm. was killed in when the house was set on fire.
And it sets a stage that still continues. And Kevin Flynn is here, and it is the book. Forget the other stuff, and it's you kick it around eBay. Are there copies out there right now, Kevin, that people can still get their hands on?
Apparently, yes. Like I said, this book's on demand. Simon & Schuster will print you a fresh one. I had never heard of this, so I called my agent. My agent verified, yes, they probably owe us a few royalties from that. so we'll get it. We'll get a buck and a quarter.
No one better. You know? And, of course, Mark Crowley. And coming up, for the first time she's going to join us, Susan Ryman's going to join us. And she was there, and she was producing. I love you both, Kevin. The best to Harriet, to everybody. Marky, thank you. Everybody, we're going to take a quick turnaround. Kevin, thanks, man, a lot. Thank you. And Mark, as always,
certainly,
see you in a minute.
Care.
All right, see you in a minute. All right, what we're going to do is Susan Ryman right after this.
News Talk 710 KNUS. Listen live at radio.com. Peter Boyles. News Talk 710 KNUS.
What an emotional morning. Good morning, everyone. 7:47, 13 before the hour. 710 KNUS, 88 and cooler, got some rain, much the same thing on Saturday. Brian Gray from Alpine is with us, and then Susan Ryman's going to join us. Happy Friday, brother man. Good morning.
Hey, good happy Friday to you as well, Pete. You know, we're not starting off too good. All three indexes we got are in the red. We got the Dow down 379 points, NASDAQ's down 44, and the S&P's down 30. Now, this is a direct correlation of the Fed's coming out saying that they're probably going to hike the rates up a little bit faster than what they thought, so that's got investors spooked a little bit. But what I wanted to kind of hit on right now is the real estate inventory. Inventory is low, and the prices, as you know, they're just going through the roof. And what is happening now is it's starting to affect all aspects of the building industry. Lumber's up over 300%. We got backlogs of appliances for 6 months, just to name a few. 57 countries have surpassed its prior peak of 2008, and house prices are growing at over 10% year over year in many countries. And one of the things that I've never seen is people are literally paying competing buyers hundreds of thousands of dollars just to walk away from property so they can get their hands on it. So the big question right now, Pete, is if I've got a mountain property or if I got something that I want to upgrade, do I sell it and take the money off the table? Do I hold on to it? What do I do? And that's one of the things we do here at Alpine Planning Group is we take a look at the full picture, try to educate you the best we can, and make the right decision. So if you got any questions, give us a call. It's getting hairy out there. It's going to be a crazy summer, but we're prepared for it.
303-843-0918. They have my trust now as well. Investing is a matter of trust, and I can't tell you how terrific Brian and the team are. They will earn yours. Try them. 303-843-0918, 843-0918. I'll give you a call this afternoon, Brian. Thanks, brother. Be safe.
You owe me that call.
Indeed.
Securities and investment advisory services offered through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA SIPC and registered investment advisor. Alpine Planning Group and Woodbury Financial Services, Inc. are not affiliated entities. 14 West Dry Creek Circle, Littleton, Colorado, 80120.
All right, good morning, everyone. On June the 18th, 1984, 37 years ago tonight, radio talk show host, the dominant talk show host in the city, Alan Berg, was killed in his driveway. And we have had a remarkable show this morning. Here's a woman I dearly love. I think we've known each other well over 40 years. Her name is Susan Ryman. She has the heart of a champion. She is works over at KOA, and she's been so much a part of all of this, and we're going to keep her with us even until the 8 to get the job done, and then some other folks are going to join us. Thank you so much, honey. Good morning. Thank you. Welcome back over here.
Good morning, Peters. Good to hear your voice. It's a sad day, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, you know, and it's, and yet in all the aftermath and all the things, you know, we find these stories that that you and I certainly share. And Kevin, of course, was a reporter. Kenny was with us. But they're laugh out loud, funny stuff that happened. And Susan, explain, tell the audience what you were doing with Alan when all of this happened.
I was Alan's producer during the day. I booked all of the guests on his show. As a matter of fact, when I was in those days, I booked all of the shows 24/7. So I produced every single show on the air, but it was always finding the guests that Alan was going to put on the air that day. And he was really picky about who he wanted on the air and what he wanted to talk about, but he was brilliant. He knew how talk radio worked. He knew what his listeners wanted to talk about and hear about, and keeping them engaged. He was brilliant.
Really was. And a lot of people took a bow about being producers and went out to Hollywood and did a lot of stuff. But the nuts and bolts were done by this woman, Susan Ryman. And we were talking earlier about Larry Crandall and the role that Larry Crandall played in all of this, too. And,
yeah.
I mean, it was the behind-the-scenes people back then, and I say this comment now, they were radio people. You're a radio woman. You're a radio guy.
I am. I started from the bottom. I started as an intern straight out of college, Colorado Women's College, as an intern, and worked hard, and they hired me right out of my internship. So I had the pleasure of actually producing Alan when we were doing All Night Live. He would fill in for Joey Reynolds.
You remember that?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh. Those were the days. And so when everyone, and this is a little bit of trivia, when I left KOA, I knew there were some three-quarter-inch tapes in the building of Alan's show, of his TV show. And I knew no one knew what they were. I knew no one knew how valuable they were. And when they fired me, I took the tapes. I did.
Great job. I mean, stealing in radio is a way of life.
I tell you what, I said those tapes are valuable because they are history, and we can't let these disappear. I knew they would just be destroyed. I took them.
He wanted to do TV, and of course I'm alcoholic and addicted, and I'm back when I'm in my. And let me put you on hold. We're going to bring you back on the other side, and then this is a wonderful woman and a dear friend, Susan Ryman, and then the ADF guys on Jack Phillips, and then these people are considering a film about the murder of Alan Berg will join us. This is that anniversary of that terrible day, June the 18th, 1984. Nobody better than Susu. Hang on your hats. I'm Peter Boyles. 88 will be the high. It's cooler. We got some rain. 85 storms likely, and Father's Day, 83 degrees. We are Radio Free Denver, good old 710 KNUS.